Okay, thank you, Ronald. So I will talk about static vacuum black hole solutions in Einstein Gaussian gravity. This is all work done in collaboration with Reinaldo Glaser at the University of Córdoba in Argentina. And I will start by making a quick review of Lovelock theory, and in particular of Einstein Gaussian gravity. Then I will recall what kind of static vacuum black hole solutions we have in higher dimensional general relativity, making emphasis in the fact that besides having holes with constant curvature horizon, we may well have black holes with more general Einstein manifolds as horizons. And then what we'll try to do is to see if we have analogous solution in Einstein Gaussian theory. In other words, what kind of limitations do we get on the horizon geometry due to the Gauss-Bonnet term? And the other thing we'll do is to study the stability of well-known Einstein Gauss-Bonnet black hole solutions where the horizon has a constant curvature. These solutions are known since about 20 years ago, but we were lacking a stability study for those. So let me make a quick review of Lovelock theory. Lovelock theory is the one where you replace Einstein tensor but by this tensor, which is a combination of the GPs. GP is order P in the curvature. And as you see, there is an anti-symmetrization here. So the number of turns you may get depends on the dimension of the spacetime. In particular, if you restrict to, say, four spacetime dimensions, you will only have the G0 and G1. So the reason to consider this tensor is that, as Lovelock has shown back in the 70s, this G tensor is the most general symmetric divergency-free tensor that you can make using the metric and up to second derivatives of the metric. So it's a natural candidate to replace Einstein tensor by another in an alternative gravity theory. So as I said before, if you go down to four spacetime dimensions, only G0 and G1 are allowed. G0 is just the metric, and G1 is Einstein tensor. So Lovelock theory reduces to Einstein theories in four dimensions, where C0 will play the role of a cosmological constant, and C1 plays the role of Newton's constant. So what we mean by Einstein Gauss-Bonnet theory is just letting the following term in, the quadratic term in the curvature. So this is the kind of theories we'll be considering, those for which G0, G1, and G2 are present. So this is a very compact form for GP. In fact, when you display it to see it in detail, you get very messy tensors. Let me show you how the Gauss-Bonnet tensor looks like. So you may imagine that except for very highly symmetric situations, it's very hard to find solutions for the full Einstein Gauss-Bonnet theory. And this tensor, string theory people source that shows up as a low energy string correction to Einstein gravity for some sorts of string theories. So Einstein gravity would be corrected by this Gauss-Bonnet piece here. So those are the theories that we'll be studying. We'll be studying vacuum solutions, so the stress energy tensor is replaced by zero in there. So before doing that, let me quickly review which kind of higher dimensional black hole solutions we have in general relativity, I mean without the Gauss-Bonnet term. So if you plug in these ansatz into Einstein equations with a possible cosmological constant, so here you see it's a static spacetime, d to the t is a time-like Killing vector, and this is what we will be calling the horizon manifold. It's an n-dimensional manifold, so the dimension for the spacetime will be n plus 2. If you plug that in to Einstein's equations, what you get is these conditions. First, the horizon manifold has to be an Einstein manifold. Then the function f has to have this form. Here k is the curvature of the horizon manifold, lambda is the cosmological constant, and mu is an integration that an integration constant. And finally, this function g has to equal 1 over f. So these are the possible static vacuum black hole solutions in general relativity. And there are many Einstein manifolds besides, you know, the trivial case of constant curvature manifold. So there is a large zoo of static black hole solutions in higher dimensional general relativity. Now, let me just briefly recall that the distinction between Einstein and constant curvature manifold is only relevant starting dimension 3. If you go to dimension 3, every Einstein manifold has constant curvature. But now if you go to higher dimensions, an Einstein manifold has a Riemann tensor that looks like this. So there is this bile piece in here, which makes the difference. So constant curvature manifolds are either isometric to spheres or hyperboloids or flat space. But now Einstein manifolds without, which are not constant curvature, you know, there are plenty of them. So the kind of questions we tried to address in the last year and a half were these. First, what kind of static vacuum solutions, black hole kind of solutions, do you get in Einstein Gaussian gravity? And some of them, of course, are well known. This sort of space-time with where the horizon manifold is a constant curvature manifold is a possible Einstein-Gauss-Bonnet solution, and it's well known. I think the original paper was James T. Wheeler back to the 85. He worked out the spherical case, and so here you put the metric of a sphere, say, and this is the f function. Again, g is 1 over f, k equals 1 in the case of a sphere. But now if you do a horizon manifold with zero or negative curvature, well, you just use, you know, the new manifold in here and change the k value there. Mu is again an integration constant that will play the role of the mass of the black hole. And if you want to recover the black hole solutions of general relativity, you have to take the alpha going to zero limit. Alpha is the coupling constant for the Gauss-Bonnet term. And you see here you have two branches. In taking this limit, the plus branch, you know, diverges, and the other one goes back to the well-known general relativity solution. This also supports cosmological solutions. You just need to set mu equal to zero, and then all this turns to be a constant. As you see, there is this plus minus sign here. So actually you get, in the mu equals zero case, two effective cosmological constants. This is generic of Lovelock theories. If you were doing Lovelock theory allowing GP up to, you know, p equal k, you'd have k branches. So here we are doing Gauss-Bonnet, that's why we have only two branches, two possible solutions like that. So as I said, these are well-known black hole solutions where the horizon has a constant curvature, known since 20 years ago.
So sorry, did you just say that the Lovelock black hole's metric always looks more or less like a flat black hole with a cosmological constant?
No, wait. I've said two things. One is that if you set mu equals zero here,
yeah,
you see you get some sort of two effective cosmological constant, and that's generic of Lovelock theory. Unless you fine-tune the coefficients so to make this square root collapse. Okay? Those theories are special and are called degenerate. And the other thing I've said is that if you want to recover the general relativity limit, so you have to make alpha go to zero. One of the branches will, you know, diverge, and the other one will give you the right limit.
Mu is the mass parameter of the black hole solution.
Mu is related to the mass parameter in the black hole solution. Yes.
The sign of kappa looks, in this Einstein case, looks like it should be positive, but that's not a restriction on the more general solutions, or am I misreading it? Does kappa have to have a fixed sign?
Yes, kappa, you can set it to plus 1, 0, or minus 1.
Oh, it can be anything.
No. Yes. Yes. Okay, so one of the things we were trying to see if you could get solutions with more general horizons. By this I mean, what if I replace a constant curvature horizon by a generic Einstein manifold? And this wasn't done, we worked it out last year, and we found that this strange condition here. So if you want to let me show this back again. If you want to do something like f dt squared plus g dr squared plus something like this, and you plug in a generic Einstein manifold in there, put it in the Einstein Galvanet equations, what you get is that the Weyl piece of the Riemann tensor of the horizon manifold has to satisfy this equation, where theta is a constant. So if, by the way, you have ever seen a condition like that, no solution for that, just let me know, because we found it very hard to find examples for that. It seems to be a very restrictive condition.
But this is assuming a symmetry.
This is assuming this form.
So
you assume this. Okay. F, G here is answers, right?
Yeah.
Leave this.
So you could find, so the metric for a general Einstein space is G bar will depend on the axis.
You might
imagine you'll find black holes, whose horizon is this Einstein manifold,
but
the functions depend on the axis.
You mean here, a function depending on the axis, or here?
Here.
Yes. Okay, but this is the other one is the condition you get if you plug in these answers. Okay.
Sure.
I don't know.
Is it obvious there aren't? Is it obvious there aren't solutions? The other side of the solution where you had the f depending on x and dr the x curve.
Yeah, it's not obvious to me when you get something really new or something that you can work out by gauge transformation to a shape like this. Yes.
I can tell you from experience, it's vastly more complicated in this case.
But I mean, it looks like some terrible physical restriction, right, that statement, and it might just be that you can't use a spherical antenna.
Well, but there could be cases where symmetries does give, I mean, S2 cross S2, for example, an Einstein metric you could put on the horizon, and you'd still have enough symmetry to justify this form without, with F being just a function of R.
Well, I don't know why it couldn't be a function of the proper size of S2 circle.
Right, exactly. Because S2 could change their radius.
But actually, S2 by S2 satisfies the condition.
But Gij bar can be dependent on R. In that case, you could have event horizon with some Bianchi 9s or Tabnat 5s special section. Such a solution has been already found in, I think, standard higher dimensional GR context. I don't know whether.
And GR.
Yeah, GR. No.
Gauss.
Yes, Gauss
Gamay. I found it with Degani last year.
One of the problems with this is that it's not only that the horizon is extensive, so that the asymptotic infinity and the geometrics are not asymptotic to that. So that means you can have GIA dependent on R, given that you can get to asymptotic.
But maybe in the asymptotic region, if Gij bar depends on R, still you can have asymptotically flat, for example, 4 or higher dimension asymptotically flat section times S1. Such a type solution.
It depends on the way, it depends on R, I guess.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's really.
Okay.
Can I ask a very naive question about the alpha goes to 0 limit? Does
it
have dimension?
Has dimension and depends on the dimension of the space-time.
Yeah, so when you say, I mean, should only take limits of dimensional quantities, so what is the actual thing?
Okay, you can guess the dimension of alpha from here, right?
do you compare in probability? Is it the radius of the black hole? I mean,
wait. So this is dimensionless. This is the one there, and so this has to be dimensionless.
Alpha lambda is unitless.
Alpha lambda is unitless. Yes.
So it's compared to lambda. So if you have no cosmological constant.
There's a power of mu.
Well, mu has units that soak up the arm, yep. So it depends on how you scale.
Of course, I should have written something like alpha over mu to some power.
No. That's a but I'm trying to understand because you've got these sure. Two branches, and I'm trying to work out what it is that, I mean, when you do a similar thing, when you've just got a cosmological constant, then really what you're saying is you're looking at small black holes, and then you don't see the cosmological constant because your black hole's smaller than the curve.
Sure.
So what's the equivalent statement here? Because it's not
when there's no cosmological constant at all, you say.
Yeah.
When you switch, if you switch off the cosmological constant.
Yeah.
Okay.
What are you comparing to? Is it something?
So
you see, you will need this times this.
Yeah. That's what I wonder. That's how.
So always, yes.
Okay, the horizon.
Should always work like alpha over mu to some power to make it dimensionless, and then you take the limit. Yeah, that's a sloppy way of saying it. No. Sorry.
In string theory, alpha will be string length squared.
It's related to the string tension, yes. Okay. Okay, so suppose you got a manifold satisfying this restriction, then the f function gets modified this way. So this new piece appears here. Kind of a surprise to me that you always get r to the fourth there in the denominator, but that's what you get. So we're now in the middle of working out, you know, plugging in a more general horizon manifold there. And except for those special theories, Gauss-Bonnet theories, where you fine-tune the parameters, what you get is that there's no other solutions besides this Einstein manifold satisfying this condition. This is work in progress with Troncoso and Oliva. So this condition on the horizon that we have found is both an algebraic condition for the Weyl tensor and a differential one, since theta has to be a constant. And it's interesting that if you go to horizon of dimension 4, due to the symmetries of the Weyl tensor, you always have this condition, except that theta is non-constant. But to higher dimension, this is no longer true. So we have been trying several different Einstein manifolds to see if we could find one satisfying this condition. And without much luck. And this is kind of an interesting example. These are bond metrics. There's a paper of Gibbons, Harnold, and Pope, where they study the stability and general relativity of black holes made with these kind of horizons. So this is the candidate horizon manifold. This is the line element for a p-sphere. This is a q-sphere. And if you want this to be Einstein, what you get in the end is a couple of system of differential equations on A and B, which cannot be solved explicitly. If you add appropriate boundary conditions on A and B, you can show that this matrix can be extended to either the sphere or a product of spheres. And what you get is, besides the standard matrix on the sphere, you get a tower of countably infinitely many more. And the same thing for the product of spheres. So if you add this horizon condition that we got from Einstein Gauss-Bonnet gravity here, what we found is that none of the non-trivial bond matrix satisfies the horizon condition. So no black holes with this horizon are possible in Einstein Gauss-Bonnet.
But sorry. That's the point. I mean,
except. Yeah. Modulo your comment.
Yeah.
Yes.
So they probably do physics.
Yes, maybe you can put more general function and make it such that at the killing horizon you get that shape, right?
Just some kind of grounds.
No, sure. Yes, sure. Okay, this is probably stronger than what I meant. Okay. However, the trivial one on the product of spheres. So if you stick to the product of the spheres with a natural metric on it, and the spheres have the same dimension, that passes the test. So that's the only possibility we found with that answer. Now let me remind you that any bound horizon is possible in general relativity, but it was shown by Gibbons, Arnold, Pope that these black holes are unstable under linear perturbation of the metric. So I don't know, maybe there is some connection between this instability and the fact that the solutions do not work in Einstein Gauss-1 net. Maybe not. Yeah. This is. Sorry? It's under linear perturbation of the metric. Tensor type.
Tensor type.
It's a paper by Gibbons, Arnold, and Pope, Physical Review D03, I guess. First conclusion is that the Gauss 1A terms restrict the possibilities for the horizon geometry for a static black hole. And what we like to see now is if we get further Gauss 1A restriction from linear stability considerations, because holes with a constant curvature horizon are known since 20 years ago, but we were lacking studies of the stability of those solutions.
Sorry, and Gibbons et al. Is only again, the SM cross N horizons are also unstable, or is that an exception?
Ah, good question. I think I'm sure it works for the non-trivial Born metrics, and I cannot remember for the SP cross SP. We should go back to the paper. Okay. Because, Born metrics are all these metrics above the SP, but the first one, which is the trivial one, is, I don't know, it's a semantic problem there. I don't know if they call it Born metric or not, because it was known before as an Einstein manifold.
Does the sign of the curvature of all the spheres matter? I mean, I'm thinking, what if you had a product of a sphere with a negative curvature space that was identified? Could they cancel each other off and satisfy the condition?
We said again, you say.
Instead of a product of spheres with spheres, you could have spheres with identified hyperboloids, and the spheres have positive curvature, and the other guys have negative curvature.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm not familiar with the arithmetic, but. It's at least thinkable to me that these things could cancel one another off to satisfy the horizon condition.
Okay, maybe, but that's not in the Bones family we have been going.
Well, it's a generalization.
Yes, not, sure. Not no, no. I'm not saying we have ruled out. I'm not saying we have ruled out all Einstein manifolds, right? We have tried many found in the literature. We were lacking of a method to solve that equation C square equals theta times delta. And
so even ones with negative curvature or mixtures of positive?
We try quite a lot, but we can go to your example and see it. It's just a matter of calculating the Weyl tensor. It's not difficult, right? It's a 5-minute calculation.
I mean, if it's a sum of different terms adding up, then there's a chance you could
Sure.
So I'm asking about.
We should try that. We should try that. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. So what we have been mainly concerned with is the linear stability study of Einstein Gauss-1 net black holes with constant curvature horizon. So let me quickly remind how this is made. In this case, we are perturbing around this metric, and this is a constant curvature manifold. So for doing that, there is a standard procedure, which is the one that you can find in papers of Kodama, Ishibashi, and Seto. The perturbation can be decomposed as a linear combination of tensor, vector, and scalar modes. The name tensor, vector, and scalar comes mainly because they are made starting from tensor fields, vector fields, and scalar fields on the horizon manifold. And these modes decouple, so you can study them separately. And as an example, let me show you how the tensor mode perturbation looks like. You start from a symmetric tensor on the horizon manifold, which is transverse and traceless on the horizon. And since the problem is linear, you can just decompose the tensor in eigentensors of the Laplace-Beltrami operator and just stick to a single harmonic mode. And you see here, this mode has just one unknown function, which is this phi. So you plug in this perturbation into Einstein-Gaussmann equation, and you end up having an equation for phi. The other modes, the vector and scalar modes, are much more complicated. You start with a lot more functions, but in the end, you get a single equation on a single function, which depends only on r and t. And this is how the equation looks like if you switch to the tortoise coordinate, which is related to the ordinary radial coordinate in the usual way, as in gr. And if you do a separation of variables like this, what you get is something that looks like a stationary Schrödinger equation, see, where the energy value equals minus omega squared. So it's fairly obvious from there that if you get a negative energy value for this Hamiltonian, then you have a real omega and you have an instability there. So the problem in the end reduces to finding a lower bound for the spectrum of quantum mechanical Hamiltonian. Except that the potential is really very complicated and very hard to make, you know, to arrive to conclusions about the spectrum of such a Hamiltonian. So as an example, let me show you one of the few things that we can show. If the machine wants to. Okay. Back. Okay, here we are. So this is what you get for tensor mode perturbations. Note that V here, the potential, is written in terms of the ordinary coordinate, so it gets much more complicated when you switch to the tortoise coordinate, because the dependence between those two is complicated for Gauss-Bonnet theory. Even though, well, this is the most compact form I can find for V. K here is given by this expression where F enters here. This is the F that shows up in the metric. And the only thing useful here is that V has this form Q plus something, and Q factors out this piece. And in here, you can find the curvature plus the harmonic of the mode you are studying. And that will turn out to be very useful, I mean, this factorization. So you may wonder, how could you possibly say anything about a quantum mechanical problem with such a potential? But there is something that helps. Again, we are borrowing from Kodama, Ishibashi, and more collaborators, this S-deformation analysis. The idea is the following. One is interested in finding a lower bound for the spectrum of a quantum mechanical problem. And you see that the expectation value for a test function phi can be written this way, where here we have introduced an S function, which could be any nice smooth function in the interval you are working. And the fact that you can write this way is just a matter of integrating by parts. It's not hard to show. But here you are decomposing the expectation value into something which is obviously positive definite, plus what we call a deformed potential. So the potential gets deformed by picking up this piece. So the way this S-deformation analysis is used is the following. Suppose you find that for a given S function, the B tilde is positive definite, then you can make sure that the operator itself is positive definite and the problem is stable. So it's used as a sufficient proof for stability. But in our particular case, due to the factorization that I showed you before of the potential, of a piece of the potential, we can use it in both ways, I show you. We have found that for this particular S function, what you get is that the expectation value of the Hamiltonian turns out to be this way. So this is certainly, this is the kinetic piece, which is positive definite. And this is the only place where the harmonic eigenvalue shows up. This is the curvature of the manifold, which can be, of the horizon manifold, which can be minus 1, 0 plus 1. And so here is this H function. And now it's rather obvious that if the H function is positive, then the whole thing is positive. You can show that this is positive, actually, even for negative curvature. And the solution is stable. But if the H function has, just a tiny negative piece, you can always fit a test function in this little negative piece to make this integral negative. And usually when you do that, if the negative piece is tiny, as I said, the kinetic term is very high. But that you don't care about, because as long as this is negative, you can be sure that for a sufficiently high harmonic, the whole thing will be negative. So the conclusion is that if H has a negative piece, the problem shows a high harmonic instability. Whereas if H is positive definite, the problem is stable. So we can work in both ways, thanks to this factorization. I should repeat that. OK. So that, what actually made it possible to arrive to some conclusions in spite of the complicated potential we had. And you may wonder if we found any interesting instability, and we did, actually. If you take the simplest possible black hole, I mean a spherical horizon, asymptotically Euclidean, so you switch off the cosmological constant, you find that the thing is stable except when the space-time dimension is 6. So a tensor mode instability was found in 6 dimension for low mass. There is a critical mass below which the hole is unstable. Now, what did we find? Yes?
So this is static spherically-symmetric black holes.
Yes. This is kind of Schwarzschild-Tangerlini, but in Einstein-Gaussian.
Did you start with a Schwarzschild metric in 6 dimensions, or are you starting with your model?
Well, the metric is it's the equivalent thing in Einstein-Gaussian. Okay. Let me go back and show you. Going to be before dinner time, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Where can I say? Near. Okay. Oh. Too much. Come on. Okay, here. So this is the closest thing to Schwarzschild you got in Einstein-Gaussian 1-8, right?
So you take your spherical horizon,
this lambda to 0. Mm-hmm.
And it's unstable only in 6 dimensions.
In 6 dimensions, under tensor mode perturbations for low mass. There's a critical mass. Below that mass, you get instability.
So you said it was asymptotic. What did you mean by asymptotically Euclidean?
Well, that lambda is 0. Asymptotically flat. Okay.
It's not asymptotically flat necessarily, because a large r is about the r squared term.
Well, if lambda is 0, large r is like doing small alpha, so you go back to this and lambda
you're
is 0.
Taking only the minus.
Sure.
Okay.
Yes.
So
this is the closest thing to Schwarzschild you got in Einstein-Gaussian 1-8, right?
So you actually found the instability when you showed this function h wasn't positive?
It's the same. So I mean, we can review the argument.
I just want to be completely clear. So h being positive implies stability.
No. H has a negative tail in that case.
Yeah, but if h is negative, that implies an instability?
For high harmonics. Yes. That implies an instability.
What does instability mean?
Well, if you can solve the problem beyond linear order.
It's high nodes on the sphere. Mm-hmm. On the
yes.
But where does it settle down to?
Well, that's a question.
But it gets more, there isn't going to be one, it's going to be an infinite number. You get a higher harmonic, so it's actually
right.
Lots of experiments to it.
I didn't really understand the argument that he said H was negative somewhere.
I can go back to that and use the black.
I didn't understand, there was also the positive definite kinetic term. So I just wonder, if something is very high harmonic, it seems like there might also be a lot of kinetic energy.
Let me make a brief annotation here. So you had the expectation value for the Hamiltonian was something like d phi square plus, let me do it simplified. You know, the harmonic, let me write it, gamma square times an integral of the deformed potential, right? Okay. Now, gamma doesn't enter this operator. So this is independent of gamma, right?
That's just an argument.
No, it's a fact.
It's what?
It's a fact. I mean, gamma is not showing up here.
D is just an argument.
No. The D is D plus S something, but gamma is not in here.
But it involves no derivatives on this here.
No, not at all, not at all, not at all.
Oh, what derivatives is it?
It's just
it's basically not a derivative. Plus a function
that's independent.
Say so. This is the only place where gamma shows up. So suppose, and well, here you got something like H, right? So usually this doesn't work in quantum mechanics because say you got a little negative piece for H here, and I say, well, I will look for a test function that is supported in here, right? So if this is too small, maybe the test function has to be too steepy, and this term increases, and you know, don't know what the balance will turn out to be, right? But now I don't care. Why? Because once I fit the test function in here, this could be a tiny negative number, this is positive, and now I increase this, and nothing else changes. And for sufficiently high harmonic, I get an instability. Is that okay? Okay, thanks. So now I have to go back.
You said this happens only in D equals 6.
Yep. For the tensor mode. But there's more coming. Okay, where am I? Tensor mode. Well, let me tell you what we got for the other modes. The tensor mode by far was the nicest. The vector mode is much more complicated, and in fact, what we've done is the following. Since the equations are so complicated, for the vector mode, what we did is to get formulas for different dimensions, up to 15 or so, and then try to guess, to interpolate the dimensional behavior. And in fact, we found formulas that we guess are the right ones, because just using 3 or 4 points fits the whole thing up to dimension 15 or so. Okay, in any case, the formulas we got work in the regime that we're interested in. So, as I said, the equations are much more complicated. And even if you get the potential, in this case, well, the potential could be deformed into some potential factoring out the harmonic eigen value, as before. But here we haven't found any interesting instability. So, no vector mode instability was found. Now, the scalar mode was even harder. The equations are much more complicated. We had to interpolate the dimensional behavior again. We were not able to write a compact form for the potential. We just gave, you know, instructions. Plug this into that and do that, that, blah, 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 to get the, you know, the Schrödinger potential. Because, you know, the most compact form would take like a couple of pages, and that's totally useless. Now, if you fix the dimension and everything, it turns out nicely. But if you want the general formula, that's very complicated. Now, the bad thing about a scalar mode is that the DS deformation trick failed. We couldn't, you know, factor out the harmonic, because the harmonic in value here appears in a rather involved way and non-linearly. So, you know, all previous argument cannot be applied in this case. So, what can we do in this situation? Well, the only thing we were able to do is to draw curves. What else you can do? And anyway, by drawing curves, we found an instability for low mass dequalified dimension now. So this is a very awful way of working, but we couldn't find any other way of doing this. Let me show you what's going on. So this is an example. This X star is actually R star, normalized to be dimensionless. So this is the potential you get when you set the mass value to 1.7, and this is the second harmonic, which is the first one relevant, and it's clearly very negative, and you can certainly fit this is a real potential, it's not deformed, right? So imagine you have a quantum mechanical problem with that potential. So it's fairly obvious that you can fit the test function giving you a negative energy value. And the thing gets a little better when you go to higher harmonics. You see, this narrows a bit, and the positive part increases. And you may think that this is the way to get out of the instability. This is the potential for a higher mass value in a high harmonic. This is how it looks like. This is the curve for the potential. It's hard to tell where this thing supports a negative energy state, but here you have one. So this is a Gaussian test function, fit around the minimum, and you can calculate the expectation value numerically. I mean, these plots are also generated numerically because it's very hard to get expressions in terms of the star variable, right? And you find that this is negative, so that's the instability I was talking about.
Maybe I'm going to make a stupid sure. point now, which no. is probably wrong, but so in a one-dimensional problem, the
yep.
potential goes negative.
Yes.
But does that guarantee?
No.
That doesn't guarantee.
No, not at all. Anything. Not at all. You have to. That's why I'm looking for.
That's a Gaussian test function. I mean, why? Why?
Okay. You if you find a function. You know, such that the expectation value of the energy of the Hamiltonian is negative, then it's because the spectrum has negative values. That's all you need.
Any function is okay.
Any function is okay. It's a test function.
The same here by the space.
So, this is the easiest guess. You have this as a table, you know, you have R values and V values.
The R negative eigenvalues, if the potential gets negative, so much.
No.
Sorry, that's
it.
No. Oh.
Which has a negative energy.
It's a variation. Now, what happens
sorry,
in general?
So why did you not take Gaussian as narrow? I mean, then it's
okay.
But there is a result, I think, in one dimension that a potential which is negative has a negative
eigenvalue. No. No, for sure it
does. The area of this potential.
Yes.
And if the area of the negative part is.
It's negative. Yes. I mean, the only result I care about is that if the potential goes asymptotically to zero, and the integral of the potential is negative, then you do have a negative. But otherwise not, because, you know, go back to the same argument, maybe it has a little tiny negative piece, but to fit a function in there, you need to make it steep in the kinetic piece. It's bigger than the other one, and everything fails. Okay. So why a Gaussian? Well, this is the easy thing I could imagine. You spot the minimum of the potential here. You fit a quadratic, like a harmonic oscillator, and then this is the lowest state of that harmonic oscillator. It's a guess, and well, that gives you a negative value. So if you go to higher mass like this, still you have, you know, a negative value using that test function. And well, if you go to high enough mass value, the thing gets essentially positive, and you get rid of the instability. It's r star. It's the radial coordinate bit.
So the horizon. I see. So this is.
No, the horizon is in minus infinity because it's r star.
So it's a funny instability that's kind of localized. It's not kind of localized near that horizon.
It's somehow.
So it's around like a stable circular orbit.
Now this perturbation is all outside the horizon, right?
You might have thought that perturbation might not actually deform the horizon, but these perturbations point to deform the
horizon. Okay. Drawings, I guess. Okay, this is going backwards. Where's that? Where's that? Like this one. I like it better now. Okay, conclusions.
Sure. Very quickly. So when you have, in fact, alpha going to zero, you don't have an instability.
Yep. That's a tricky limit.
And then, but you don't have an instability.
You don't. I mean, no, wait.
Well, where is the where?
In general relativity, you don't have an instability.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Well, here, you see.
Yeah.
This is what matters. New Ralph.
In every case, your instability is only for small mass black holes.
Sure.
And small is at some scale sent by alpha.
Yeah.
Can I understand that the
string scale black
hole? Yeah. Perturbation, the horizon condition is automatically satisfied.
What do you mean by the horizon condition?
Horizon condition, the y curvature times y curvature equal constant. And you might perturb this one.
Oh, these are constant curvature black holes, right?
But does the perturbation satisfy?
Well, the kind of thing I perturb in are the constant curvature, the old black holes of Wheeler back to the 85. No, we haven't done the perturbation around the more general. Yes. So this is, that's why I say this is the closest thing to Schwarzschild in Einstein Gauss 1A, right?
I have a question. For these d equal 5 black holes in this theory, there's actually a minimum mass.
There is minimum mass, which in this scale would be 1.5. That's why I started from 1.7.
So it's everything's above that minimum.
Yes. You see, the first transparency was on the potential of 1.7, do you remember? And 3/2 of mu alpha equals 3/2 is the minimum possible. Then you don't have a black hole at all. Yeah, thanks for the comment. Okay, so conclusions then. we think the reason to study higher dimensional gravity theory is because string theory suggests that would be useful, and since the Einstein-Gauss 1A theory contains the dominant string correction, we think that it's useful to see what happens when this term is taken into account. And so we found that most black holes with Einstein manifolds of non-constant curvature are not allowed when the Gauss 1A term is switched on. And then we found that the simplest black hole solutions that were known since 20 years ago are not stable for low mass in some particular dimensions. So let me recall you that what we found is a scalar instability in d equal 5 and a tensor instability in d equal 6. And I think that's all I have to say. Thank you.
So does that mean that d larger than 6, did you find any instabilities there, or is everything?
No, but you see, with the scalar perturbation, we couldn't do any systematic work. So we're just, you know, plotting potentials and see what happens. Oh, see what happens here in D equals 6. But that's not...
still unknown.
Sure.
Is the problem simplifying the limit of large mass and perhaps large harmonic number as well?
No.
No, really?
I mean, the harmonic enters in a very weird way in here. It's very... maybe there's, you know, it depends on how much time you spend on it, I guess. But not in 1 month.
Can I?
Sure.
Another question. So, instead of taking the lambda equal zero limit, just put mu equal zero.
And keep lambda.
Yeah, but keep lambda.
Mm-hmm.
And keep lambda negative, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, in some sense, just a perturbation of pure ADS.
Mm-hmm.
The background is pure ADS, but the equation of motion for perturbation actually must satisfy the perturbation of the Gauss Bonnet equation. In that case, what kind of potential do we have? This potential becomes non-trivial even for GR case. And in particular, the D equals 5 dimension, that's very interesting.
Uh-huh. We have to do that.
But that case is quite simple and perhaps simplistic.
Sure, we can work it out. I mean, we have all the formulas. There are so many different cases you may want to explore that. So we said, partly motivated by all these speculations about getting, you know, black holes in accelerators and all that, I say, well, what kind of things do we actually have?
Most interesting case in asymptotic ADS one is D equal 5.
Okay, good.
Scale of perturbation.
I mean, we can look at the formulas afterwards if you want and see. Okay. Thanks for comment.
So, are there any uniqueness theorems known for this kind of black holes?
No, but we have all the material to work on the uniqueness thing. So, you just, you know, uniqueness is related to E equals zero, like omega equals zero. You are finding, like, searching for static perturbation somehow.
So, that would be the infinitesimal uniqueness.
So this is the thing I was planning to work on.
Okay. But without saying non-theorems in the nonlinear case where you throw in, say, staticity and, well, I don't know, some kind of asymptotic behavior and regularizing?
Not that I know. I don't know. Maybe. Nice thing I was on it, not that I know.
Wouldn't it make sense to take a mu going to small limits of the potentials, since that's where you see the instabilities?
Okay, in the whole thing, in the scalar case.
I mean, have you tried to do that?
We tried many different things and couldn't find anything that you could show.
Like
anything, you know, neat.
I think maybe that it simplified, I mean, the potential
simplified. It's simplified, but not enough. It's, you know, the expression for the potential are really complicated in terms of R. And the connection between R and R star in EGB is very complicated also. Because in EGB, you know, the F function has a square root. And maybe step by step, I don't know. I mean, eventually you get a little sick of the formulas, but we haven't done anything. We tried, you know, a number of things.
But like in string theory, should the interpretation of this mean that the like for very small black holes, the black hole should decay into string states instead?
I don't know any string theory, but this is telling you that the black hole will decay into something.
But because...
Well, that's a case where you can trust...
Yeah.
It's
strictly...
Oh, I see.
...zero where it's substring, so you need a lot on it.
No. Sure.
So. I see.
Maybe it's like, if you think of the correspondence principle between black holes and strings, and maybe for sufficiently small black holes, you should get string states. Maybe the instability makes sense in that kind of, for, I mean, from that point of view.
I certainly agree that small black holes turn into strings.
Yeah.
But I don't think you'd see that by a sort of an ordinary classical conservative analysis of some, you know, gravity theory.
No, but I mean, maybe it makes sense at least.
It's not related, right? Because the coursework directions and assumptions are really integrating out all the massive fields.
Mm-hmm.
although intermittently is limited, it's related to the gradient of the classical dynamics. So, yes, in terms of this problem.
Yes, yes.
It's
all
higher power.
Absolutely.
They all become important.
Yeah,
at the
same time. You have to include everything.
Yeah, well, in dimension 5 and 6, we don't have those many higher power.
No, you do.
You do? Oh, okay. I see. Yeah, right. No Lovelock kind of correction. Okay. Not Lovelock. Okay. Okay.
Sorry, the same order of alpha. Well, are you saying you need all the orders in alpha?
Yes, you need all the orders in alpha prime because the leading order term is important when the curvature becomes more of the string scale. And when that happens, all the higher powers and higher orders of alpha prime.
Oh, I see, I see, that's the point.
Yeah.
I see.
Okay, well, let's thank this other one again. Tomorrow, another discussion.